We're not quite done with the chapter. We talked about some exceptions to Mendelian genetics. There's a couple more left in this slideshow. Starting with 13, this example involves rats, as you see. How many characteristics are we looking at here?
Only one.
One, which is what?
Color.
Fur color, correct. Notice there's three traits, black, brown, and white. Look at the genotype, though. What does the genotype tell you here at the top? What do genotypes tell you in general? What is a genotype? Right, it's a symbolic listing of all the alleles for whatever gene you're talking about. So what would you expect a genotype to look like for one characteristic that we're talking about? Like, what was it for the first example we ever looked at, which were the pea flower color?
It would be only one pair of alleles, right?
One pair for a diploid, or just a single for a gamete, a haploid, right? And why just one pair? What does that indicate to you?
One characteristic,
which corresponds to one gene, right? You have two alleles for the same gene. So how many genes are we looking at here? Two genes, but we just said we're talking about one characteristic, right? That's what's different here. That's the reason that it is an exception to Mendelian genetics. What we have here is a type of gene interaction. The name for this is epistasis. Epistasis is the situation in which the product of one gene affects whether a different gene is enabled or turned on. All right? So that's why it's gene interaction, but it's a specific kind of gene interaction. Now, we have here a B gene and a C gene, as you see here, each of which has two possible alleles. So uppercase B or lowercase B for the B gene, uppercase C or lowercase C for the C gene. The B gene is the gene whose protein product gives the fur its particular color. And B here stands for black, even though it also stands for brown, but it's really standing for black because black is dominant over brown. Okay? So lowercase b is the brown allele. Lowercase b means if it's a homozygous recessive individual for the B gene, in other words, lowercase b, then the particular color of pigment that individual makes is brown instead of black. If it's one black allele, one uppercase B or more, because of dominance, then black will be made instead of brown. All right, that's clear enough, hopefully. But the C gene has as its protein product, if it's made, a protein that turns on the B gene. In other words, the B gene does not get expressed, doesn't get turned on, unless the C gene's protein product allows it to get turned on. And that will happen only if there is an uppercase C allele. So the C here stands for coloration gene. It doesn't determine the color. It determines whether any color gets put into the hairs. If no color gets put into the hairs, then they look white to us. And this is why if a rat has two recessive C alleles, lowercase c, lowercase c, then it doesn't matter what color the B gene says the pigment is going to be, because that gene stays turned off. And notice here that the B's don't matter in any of these four white rats, because lowercase c means no product, no protein is produced in these rats that will allow the B gene to be turned on. But in any rat that has at least one uppercase C, then the protein that's made indirectly by the C gene allows the B gene to get turned on, and then it depends on the version of B alleles that the rat has as far as what color the fur will be, either black or brown. So all that makes sense? One gene affecting the expression of another. It's epistasis. Okay, slide 14. Before I get to 14, I want to tell you about another one, because I don't have a picture for it. So after epistasis, call it slide 13 and a half, the next exception is called pleiotropy. And in some sense at least, pleiotropy is kind of the reverse of epistasis. So epistasis is more than one gene determining a single characteristic. So it's kind of like a convergence coming together. Pleiotropy, the reason it's kind of the opposite of epistasis, is that in that situation you have one gene affecting multiple different characteristics. So it's kind of like a divergence instead of a convergence. And an example of this is an example we've talked about already for different reasons. I think already twice we've used the example of sickle cell disease in this course, because we looked at it in terms of mutation. But it's also an example of pleiotropy, because that sickle cell, the particular sickle cell alleles that an individual has, or I should say hemoglobin alleles, there's the normal and the mutant form. But depending on which hemoglobin alleles an individual has, that affects not only hemoglobin molecules, the shapes of them, but it also affects the actual disorder, whether or not the individual has a disorder, which are two different characteristics. All right, so that's one. Pleiotropy is a single gene affecting simultaneously multiple characteristics. Now we can go to 14. And this is an example of what's called polygenic inheritance. Now, what does polygenic tell you? What does that mean? Right. Polygenic linguistically means many genes. So polygenic inheritance refers to a characteristic that is affected by several different genes simultaneously. And this example uses human skin color as an example. It's not the only example, but it's one that's familiar to us as humans. And what is represented here are many different shades of brown, corresponding to many different possible human skin colors. You know, it's pretty ridiculous that we say black and white all the time. There's no such thing as either type person. There's no white person. There's no black person. All people are some shade of reddish brown. The reddishness comes from the blood that you see through the skin. And the brownness comes from the melanin, the pigment that's deposited in keratinocytes of the skin. And that the amount of that melanin that's produced depends on the individual. It's genetically determined. But it's determined by several different genes. So there is a, you know, there isn't, aren't, not only are there no whites or black in humanity, there's also not just two possible colors, right? There's all kinds of shades. That's represented by this extremely light, extremely dark, and everything in between grid that we see here. So it's, instead of being two or maybe some small number of possible traits, like it was for other things we've looked at, the actual phenotype varies along a continuum from between two extremes, everything in between. And that's because multiple genes are involved. So that's what's really represented here by these circles. I don't know that it's exactly six genes in humans. That's just the cartoon that's shown here. These six circles, though, represent six different genes that each contribute to human skin color. And each gene has two possible alleles, a light or a dark one, a white or black circle. And depending on how many of them are light and how many of them are dark, will determine the overall darkness of the skin in that individual. So that's called polygenic inheritance. You see the same thing in a lot of animal fur colors, like horses, for instance. Okay, now to 15. What kind of flowers are we looking at here? These are hydrangeas. And hopefully, it doesn't matter that you know what the species is, but hopefully you can recognize that these are the same species, right? So you have two individuals that, unless you're colorblind, obviously differ in their flower color traits, right? One's pink, one's blue. And that's nothing new. We've looked at different flower colors before in this course. So it would be reasonable for you to assume, well, one of them has the pink allele, one of them has the blue allele for flower color. That explains it. Except that in this example, as far as the flower color gene is concerned, these two organisms are genetically identical. They have exactly the same genotype. So how is it that two organisms with the same genotype can differ phenotypically? Well, that's actually getting more detail than I am asking for. But more generally, if they have the same genes, how do they end up having different phenotypes, have different traits? Right, there is an environmental component to phenotype. Now, obviously, there is a genetic component to phenotype. We've been talking about that the whole chapter. Genes matter. The specific alleles that you have matters as far as your trait is concerned. But it's more than just a genetic component. phenotype also has an environmental component. And so this idea is kind of expressed in the old phrase, nature versus nurture. Nature refers to the genotype you're given, which you don't really have any choice in. And that matters to a great degree, but not entirely. Nurture refers to how you are brought up, right? So if you imagine two identical twins, it's an accident that happens, right? It doesn't happen just on its own. It has a zygote splits into two. It was supposed to just be one zygote. And so they're genetically identical, and then they develop into separate embryos, fetuses, and then babies. They're born genetically identical. And they look a hell of a lot alike, right? Because of the genetic component. But if they're separated at birth and lead 80-year lives in different parts of the world doing different things, totally different environments, they're unlikely to still be identical after 80 years, right? That's because genes don't tell the whole story. In this case, the reason the flower colors are different is because the pH of the soil is different. There actually is a third color these could be, depending on the range of the pH. All with the same exact genes. And another example of how environment affects phenotype is that one of these two twins could be a bodybuilder and the other not, right? They're going to have entirely different body types after years of bodybuilding in just one of them, even though they have the same genes. So the environmental component is really important. Now in 16, I don't want to spend a hell of a lot of time on this, but this has to do with pedigree analysis. A pedigree is a family tree. And so we draw family trees for various reasons to figure things out. Now, when I talked about that test cross, that one type of test cross that was designed to determine the genotype of an individual with the dominant phenotype, the pink-flowered individual, I said that the way you figure it out is you look at your two possible Punnett squares, which give you different predictions about offspring, and then you actually go through with the cross, right? Well, you can't do that with humans for ethical reasons. And even if you could ethically, it would take you a long time to do this, right? You can't, especially if you had to go through multiple generations. You can't force humans to breed for you just for the sake of figuring out genetics. So this is why I don't want to spend too much time on this, because it's kind of an old-fashioned idea now, since we can just go into an individual and look at the DNA so easily nowadays. We couldn't do that until recently, though. So we would have to devise family trees based on our knowledge of the families, these pedigrees, and then figure out what genotypes were just based on logic, right? For instance, if an individual has a recessive phenotype, you know from what we've said about dominance that means the genotype is homozygous recessive, right? That means each of the two parents had to contribute a recessive allele to that individual. So that tells you something about that individual's parents, regardless of what their phenotype is, because you can be heterozygous and have a recessive allele but not express the recessive trait and so on. That's what pedigree analysis is all about. And in 17, we're looking at a couple prenatal tests that can be used to determine the genetic composition of an embryo or fetus during pregnancy, obviously. And these both really are just ways of sampling the DNA so that you then can run tests on the DNA. The real difference about them is when they are conducted. and they're really, A and B are switched in terms of which one's earlier. A is amniocentesis, which is done later. So this is a fetus we're looking at. And a fetus more or less swims in what is called amniotic fluid in the uterus. And so fetal cells get sloughed off the body of the fetus, and they are found in that fluid. So you can sample the fluid itself, draw some out with a needle, and that will give you enough DNA to work with to figure out what the DNA of the fetus is. For whatever reason, like for testing to see whether it has any possibility of living. Earlier, you can do the same thing, but it's a different test. It's chorionic villus sampling. Now remember, we talked about villi in the small intestine, for instance. A villus is just a finger-like projection. There's different places that have villi, like the tongue. Well, the chorion is one of the layers of the embryo. So this is earlier. This is pre-fetal. This is an embryo. It's labeled as a fetus. It might be very early fetus, but you could also do it as a late embryo. But anyway, the reddish stuff is the placenta, which is an interesting organ, really, because it's partly the mother's body and partly the embryo's body. It's where they come together and exchange materials. So it's where the fetus or late embryo gets nutrition from, and it's where waste gets put into from the embryo or fetus. But anyway, these finger-like projections of the chorion are just chorionic villi, and all you have to really do is get in there with a suction tube and suck some of that placental material out, and that will give you DNA for the embryo as well. That looks like that's the chapter, because 18 and 19 are two pages of summary, so I've talked about all of these before. It's just your standard end of chapter summary, like in some of the chapters.